I really believe God's got something to say. All right, let's get into this real quick. Exodus chapter 2, verse 1. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. I didn't tell them that. So, oh, they do have it. Well, how about that? All right, very good. It says this. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took of his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that the child was, that he was a fine child. Everyone say, he's so fine. Kind of hard to think of Moses that way, isn't it? She hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and dabbed it in bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done with him or to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. What they were doing is looking for crocodiles. She saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her servant woman, and she took it, and when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I'll give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And when the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." God bless you. You may be seated. I'm going to get right into this, and I'll give you a title in just a moment. We're in the summer stretch series, and I hope I can stretch your faith, and I hope I can stretch you to the positive side of understanding, as it's already been said, who you are in God. What we just read is a very fantastic story that has been taught and recited in Sunday school after Sunday school for years and years and years and years and years. In fact, if you've been in church any amount of time, you've heard this story. And if you were in church as a child, this was one of the first stories that you learned. The story starts out normal. Man marries woman. Woman has baby. But then the story takes a turn in just one phrase. When she saw that the child was fine, she hid him 3 months. Why in the world would a mom hide her baby? Unless he's ugly. Now, I know you guys are thinking, now, Pastor, you're kind of losing your mind because we know the end of the story, right? But you're going to have to try to take yourself back as if you don't know the end of the story, and that is you don't understand what the ending's going to be. And so the question still begs to be answered. Why in the world would a mom hide her baby? But think about it. No mother hides her baby, right? Have you ever noticed there's never been born an ugly baby? Now, y'all are getting tight on me here because you know there's some ugly babies out there. Pastor, you're not supposed to say that. No, it's true. Everybody's baby except yours is possibly ugly. Right? And now, listen, there are some beautifully born babies. My grandchildren are some of the most beautiful born babies that have ever been on the face of the planet and ever will be. Right? Just being honest. And then there's some other babies you're like, "Ooh, you really shouldn't Instagram that. They need time. They need help." But no, seriously, she hides him. And we know why she hides him, but she hides him. She makes this makeshift boat, and she sends him down the river, no less. And none of this makes sense unless you know the backstory. And again, I dare say every one of us here know the backstory. In the case you don't know, or maybe you've forgotten, let me narrate this for you really quick. You'll find the story in Exodus 1. Pharaoh is in full panic mode. He is completely freaked out about the growth of the Hebrew children and how large they're becoming. And so he orders all the birth males to be killed. But that doesn't work. And so then he employs all the Egyptians that if they can find them to throw every male child into the river. Moses, no matter the backstory, no matter who his daddy was, his life starts out hidden. And that's what I want to preach about today is that hidden for a purpose. And just when Moses is getting to the stage of where he is making faces, he's smiling and he's cooing and he's doing what babies do at this stage, Mom sends him down the river. She's not only hid him for 3 months, but she's also sent him now down the river. Can I just ask you something with an honest answer today by just a raise of hands? Do sometimes you get the feeling that no one sees you? Go ahead. You walk around in life, you're at the job, maybe it's even in your own home, in your community, maybe even in this church, and you start to feel that no one sees you, that you're just another number, just another body. You're just someone else sucking the oxygen which God has given us, and that's it. Can I say that God isn't hiding you for no reason? He's not hiding you for the purpose of keeping you and me unseen. He's hiding us because he is protecting us. Yes, God is protecting us from some things that are intended. Watch this. And here's my word to you. God is hiding us for the purpose of protecting us from things that would destroy our reputation, hurt and malign our hearts, and possibly kill our spirits. He's not just hiding us, he's protecting us for what will become our destiny. Can I be very transparent with you? It's the only way I know how to do this. The last several years, things have drastically changed for me in ways that I never even saw coming. I never imagined it. And so I used to be in Augusta, Georgia at the church that I started and planted, and now I hail from East Tennessee, which I have come to understand is pretty much God's country. Love it up there. It's something that I didn't think I would like very well, but I've fallen in love with it. But even so, we found a great church, and I mean a powerful church, a church that the Spirit is flowing and things are happening. Man, you go in there and the presence of God is moving and great things are happening. This place is packed out wall to wall, every service, and it is just absolutely incredible, the feeling that you get, the presence of God that you can feel just wrap around you. And at my best ability, I've tried to get to know people, and it's really different when you're a pastor and you come into a church. Everybody's just kind of like, whoa, 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 what's he here for? And even the pastor he's arm's length distance, and he's scared a little bit, and he's nervous because he's been hurt. And yes, there's been some ruthless people come in and try to destroy his church or take what he has away from him. And at my best attempts to get to know him, he has refused to get to know me. And so I sit in a church on some Sundays when I'm not out preaching, not known, my name is not known, I don't get to preach. I don't get to do anything. I feel unseen. Is that too much for anybody in here? Is that too honest? I feel as if I've been put out to pasture. And I'm questioning my very existence and why I am still here on this earth. And I've questioned, God, why in the world am I hidden? Why in the world it has seemed that I've been pushed off into the corner, put into the closet, if you will, with a door locked and not able to get out and do what you've called me to do and not able to be who I thought you had called me to be. And it feels like I am being hidden. But somewhere, somehow, what has happened in my mind and in my spirit is I begin to realize I'm not being hidden for the purpose of God hiding me. I'm being hidden for the purpose of God protecting me. You see, he's not just hiding us, he's protecting us for what will become our destiny. Your boss not seeing you at work? not recognizing your achievements, not recognizing who you are and how much you put into the job and how loyal you are to the firm. God's hiding you before it's time. You see, when we're born into the kingdom, we don't just jump into our destiny and then we're like, yes, I'm here, I've arrived. When we're born into the kingdom, we don't jump into destiny, we grow into our destinies. Babies don't hurt anybody, right? They bring joy. They bring so much peace and happiness. Well, except for the 2, 3, and 4, and 5 o'clock feedings. And that thing they do, you know, in their britches. Other than that, they're just such a bundle of joy. And so why on the earth would Pharaoh be so concerned with babies? Oh, he was trying to stop the population. No, see, babies never hurt anyone. Babies never amass an army. Babies, they just eat, sleep, and repeat. Babies, you know, they mess their diapers and they can require constant care. And so Pharaoh wasn't afraid of babies in their current form. He was worried about which one of them would become Moses. The enemy isn't attacking us because he's worried about who we are in the moment. He's worried about what you and I will become when God finishes his perfect work. Exodus 1, 9 through 10, he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel, they're too many and they're too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. You see, I find it funny that the enemy seems to know more about our potential than we do. Did y'all hear that? Do you understand? I believe the enemy knows more about your potential than even you know about your potential because of how we act. I've got trouble in my marriage. Perhaps the enemy is attacking you there because he knows what you'll become and what you'll bring to the table when you've been through the fire. I've got trouble on the job. Well, perhaps it's because he knows what you'll bring to the table when you mature in Jesus and you begin to show an entire company what it is to be Christ-like. I've got health issues. Well, perhaps the enemy knows that if he could take you out now, he doesn't have to worry about the fact that when you are healed and when you do come through the medical mess, you're able to put your hands on somebody and see them healed and recover. But I've got questions. God, why? Why does it seem that you're hiding me when I should be in my prime? And this is what I know, and this is what God revealed to me not too long ago. He's protecting me from things I don't even know about. And now what it comes down to, pure trust. You see, Psalm 32 and 7 says, you are my hiding place for me. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with shouts of deliverance. Psalm 27, 5, for he will hide me in the shelter, in his shelter in the day of trouble. He'll conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. Psalm 31, 20, in the cover of his presence, he hides me from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. You see, all three verses, all three references, it talks about cover, shelter, being in total obscurity, where men, people who would then have it out for you, they can't find you, they can't touch you. And yet we're sitting back going, why can't I see my way out? Why can't I? When is it my turn? Anybody ever ask that? When do I get the stage? When do I have success? When do I get the bonus? When do I look back and say, I've got the perfect marriage? And the whole time you're questioning yourself, God, where are you? What's happening? Why am I hidden? Why am I underneath something? Can I tell you, I've learned that God does his best work in the dark. Romans 8:28, it says this, for you know those that love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. We're talking about being hidden for a purpose. You see, these things themselves may not be good, when he says all things, it means, what does all things mean in the Greek? What does it mean? It means all things. I know that's mind-boggling, it's mind-blowing. It means all things, the good, the bad, the pretty, the ugly, and the occasional indifferent. All things work to the good. All things work for the good to them that love him and are called according to his purpose. Again, these things may not be good in of themselves, but God has a way of harmonizing things together for the believer's ultimate good, because his goal is to bring us into perfection in his presence. Even adversities and afflictions contribute to this end. How in the world can adversity? I mean, I can only take so much, God. How can adversity contribute to my ultimate good? But here's the interesting thing. When he talks about he works together, this is a very present tense type of verb in our language, and it really is emphasizing that God is in continual activity of being sure that no matter how rough it gets or how bad it gets, it will work out for our good. Come on, somebody needs to grab a hold of that today. No matter what you're fighting, no matter what you're facing, it will work out for our good. The word purpose in Romans 8:28 is the same word that means plan. And to me, that is so much more intimate. When it comes to my walk with God, is it's not just some abstract purpose, but he has a plan. Yeah, but I went through a divorce, preacher. I didn't expect it. I didn't see it coming, but the divorce happened. There is a plan. I'm going through bankruptcy. It's okay. There is a plan. I don't feel right in my body. The doctor says something wrong. It's okay. There is a plan. There's a plan. Oh, America's going to hell in a handbasket. Guess what? There is a plan. Come on, somebody. No matter what it is, there's a plan that God has for our lives. But we are the J.G. Wentworth Society. It's my money and I. I mean, right now. And then it gets worse. Now we can sell our life insurance policies and get cash now. Don't do that. Please don't do that. But it just tells the story of who we are as a generation. That's why fast food is so appetizing and so wonderful and lovely. I don't have to wait 30 minutes for it unless you're at McDonald's at a certain corner at a certain time of the day. Then it's all bets are off. We want it now. We want everything now. I want to be successful now. I want that ministry now. I want this church to be packed out now. And by the way, it looks better in here, and I think I've seen it in years. And it's summer. Thank you, Lord. But where do we get off as people, humans, thinking that we can demand of God that the plan unfold now. Man, I was great as long as I was pastoring, preaching every week, watching people come into church and leave. I thought I had arrived. I thought I was doing what God called me to do. And then things begin to change in my life, completely out of my control. Nothing I did, just things begin to happen. And stuff began to change. And I'm screaming, God, now, where's your plan now? God, where are you right now? Anybody ever just felt like God wasn't existent? Yeah. Well, preacher, you know, you can't say that because that's never happened to you. Okay. So we want it now. We want the plan now. We want the success now. We want the issue to be resolved now. But has anybody ever gotten a piece of fruit that you wanted right now and you bit into it and it wasn't ripe? You ever done that? Now, I know some of you Georgia folk, y'all bite into Vidalia onions. Y'all just crazy. Y'all eat them like apples. That's stupid. Stay away from me. But fruit, you expect it to be sweet. You expect it to be ready. And you bite into it and you realize, oh, my God, this is terrible. It's like biting into a persimmon. You know, it's just, ugh. There's nothing worse than tasting fruit that is sour, meaning fruit that is harvested before it was ready. Back when I was a kid, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 years old, out on the farm, and I told my dad, I said, I want to plant watermelons. I want to grow watermelons. He said, okay. So they gave me a little 5-acre parcel. And me and my buddy John Hood, never forget that guy. I've lost touch with him. I have no idea where he's at. But we were in Middle Georgia down in Perry, between Perry and Fort Valley, Georgia, and on this little 5-acre track that they gave me to be able to do watermelons. I went out there, and we took the equipment, and man, we did it. My family had a wholesale distributorship for farm machinery, and so I had all the equipment at my fingertips, and so, you know, I borrowed the tractor, got the equipment from my dad, and boy, we tore off out there, and we did our best to create these mounds for watermelons, and we went in, and we planted every one of those watermelons by hand, every single plant by hand. And oh, thanks be to God, it rained, and man, the soil was good. And, you know, a couple days later, a little shoot started coming up through the ground, and man, I was giddy. I was like, yes, I'm going to have watermelons, and I'm going to be rich. Because everybody loves watermelon. If you don't, we have an altar here for you. And so they begin to grow. And me and my buddy John, we went out there every day, and we were by hand on 5 acres taking care of weeds, doing our thing. And finally, our plants got big enough. They were handling it, and they, you know, the weeds weren't affecting them anymore, and man, it was awesome. And the next thing you know, I begin to see these little buds happening. And the next thing you know, oh, my gosh, I looked out there one day, and there's little watermelons everywhere, little baby watermelons. And I was such a proud papa at that moment, at, you know, 14, 15 years old. I was like, yes, I did this. We're going to rule the world with watermelon. So they got to a certain size, and I was getting giddy. I was like, yeah, boy, we're fixing to make some money now. So out there, we're walking along among our watermelons, and we're just proud as peach, man. We're just looking around, and we're like, yeah, this is going to be great. And I began to look at these watermelons. I said, man, I think we're getting close. My buddy John looked at me and said, yeah, I think so too. And we're walking, and just by sheer accident, I came here. I busted one of the watermelons by accident. A minute thing opened up, and it was just beautifully red, and I was like, oh. And I reached in there, and I grabbed a handful. Juice is running down my face, and I'm like, oh, my God. This is it. We are in the Mecca. This is nirvana for us. This is it. And then I said, we got to do another one. So we went and busted another one. And, man, it was good. I was like, oh, yes. So, boy, we took off, and we ran home, and I got my dad, and I said, Dad, the watermelons are ready. He said, you serious? I said, yep. The rest said, look. He took a taste. He said, okay, let's do it. So he had this big truck. It was like a 25,000-pound gross weight vehicle truck. And we laid it down with hay in the back. And then we just, man, we were out there. We were chunking watermelons to each other. We worked all day. And the next day, we finally got the truck loaded. And then we were planning on leaving the next day on a Friday morning to head to the farmer's market here in the Atlanta area, which I think was south of the airport at the time. And, man, we were going to sell our watermelons and make all this cash. You know, $1 million was going to be our take. We just knew it. We got up there, and this guy jumps in the back of the truck and says, man, you got quite a haul here. I was like, yeah, we do. We did it. Me and my buddy, we all by ourselves, we did it. It's us. He cut open a watermelon, and I didn't see that bright red, juicy stuff that I saw on the first two watermelon that we busted. He goes, oh, this one's not ready. Oh, I will just chunk it. Just get the other one. He did that one. After about 5 or 10 watermelon, he looked at us and said, none of these are ripe. He said, I don't have to bust anymore. I can look on the outside and tell you right now that none of the rest of these are ripe. You want to talk about disappointment? I said, what do we do? He said, well, we're not buying them. And my $1 million check went out the window. We ended up having to go back and unload the truck, and we had to lay them out in the sun and let them try to ripen just by the sunlight. It was an utter, total failure, because we all know, I think, by now that when you raise fruit, it's best to ripen on the vine than off the vine. What happened? We got too eager. We wanted it now. We got too big of a hurry, and we were begging for this watermelon to be right now, but we needed to wait at least another week. But we wanted it now, and we nearly destroyed the whole thing. Now, the bad part is we were able to take the watermelon up to the thing, you know, just a week or so later, and we did get them sold, but we got them sold for half the price we would have gotten if we had waited just 1 week. And I know we often get in a hurry and we want things to happen in our lives right now, but I'm telling you, if we'll just wait on Jesus. You know, Malachi 3:11, and we know these verses because we know it's all about giving and what have you, but there's a principle in here that I want you to get out of this. And the King James Version says, I will rebuke the devourer for your sake, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall, watch this, your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field. New Living Translation says, your crops will be abundant, for I will guard them from insects and disease. Your grapes will not fall from the vine before they are ripe, says the Lord. And then in the Evening Standard Version, I'm going to rebuke the devourer for you, and I will not destroy the fruits of your soul, and your vine in the field shall not fail to bear. What's he saying? I will protect you if you wait on me and get ready for the harvest. If you'll wait on me. I've got a word for somebody here today. You've been wondering why, and you've been wondering how. You've been wondering when, but I'm here to tell you, if we'll wait on God and understand that our obscurity is for a purpose, we're beaten, hidden for a purpose, and if we'll wait on Jesus, he is going to reveal our destiny in due time. We shall reap if we faint not. But here's the problem with jumping too early. You see, Moses in Exodus 2:11, he sees an opportunity to do something for God. And it said one day when he grows up, when he had grown up, he went out to his people and he looked on their burdens and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. I want you to understand something. Moses had vision. Moses had good intent. Moses had a good heart. He had compassion and he had passion and he had the want to, but it wasn't time. And he ends up murdering an Egyptian and it set him back 40 years. Well, I've been in this church thing all my life and I'm still not seeing what I want to see. Why don't we try submitting our time schedule to Jesus' time schedule? Let me close with this. What's next? When? Where? How? I've shared some of my story with you, and I have let you in a little bit of my past, these past 5 or 6 years, and been some of the hardest times in my life with these glimpses of glory and beauty and happiness and peace, and then it seems like back to the grind as soon as the peace comes, and it's just been debilitating sometimes and extremely disoriented. I've had people who called themselves my friends who have walked away. It seems like God stripped them out of my life and they've walked away from me and wanted nothing else to do with me for no apparent reason. I've had more pain than I thought that I could handle. And all of this left me with massive question. I've had people that I served and I loved all of a sudden look at me and say, "We don't want you a part of this anymore." Why? Things are different now. Things have changed. What's changed? Everything. You didn't do what we wanted you to do when we wanted you to do it. So we're choosing a different path. So I was left with questions. What next? When? Where? How? I went to a pastor's retreat. And while I was there, this massive acreage, and I was, it's down by the coast, and it's actually sponsored by Pastor Greg Surratt in Seacoast Church, and then multiple pastors across the country. They all support this thing, and pastors go there for 3, 4, 5 days, and they just kind of detox and just get with other pastors, and they're able to confess all kinds of crazy things without fear of retribution and judgment. And they're able to express their fears. They're able to talk about where they're at in their life at their time and what's going on in their ministry. And some show up and, man, they're at the top of their game. They're feeling good. They're feeling high. Everything's great. And then there's others who are like me that were at the bottom and questioning their very existence. And I remember I was walking through the property and I wandered way, way, way out away from the place that we were staying. And there was this little trail and I just walked and I just began to cry and sob basically to the point where I could hardly see. But I just kept walking. And while I was in that moment, I was able to pray a prayer that I had never prayed before. And some would maybe be embarrassed as a preacher, pastor, to admit that they prayed this prayer. But I did. And this is what I prayed. I said, "God, I don't want to know, just know. I don't want to just know your love academically." Meaning, I know what this says. I've made it a point to study it. This has been my life. And I've shared this with thousands and thousands of others through the years. All walks of life, all four corners of this country, and even in some other countries that I've been to. I've shared this gospel. I've been there. I've talked about your love, God. I've talked about all these great things that I know you're capable of. And I've talked about all you, who you are, that how you gave your life for us. And I understand all of that academically. I get it. But God, I don't want to just know your love academically, but I want to feel your love personally. And that's hard to admit, that it took right at 50 years for me to finally pray that prayer. And I'm going to tell you something. That is a very dangerous prayer. I had no idea the Pandora's box that I opened that day. And so I sat around a table after praying that prayer with, I don't know, 20 other pastors. And we sat there and we shared our lives with each other, complete strangers at that moment. And I shared my life of what I had been through recently and how I experienced one of the greatest losses of my life. And I'm just pouring it out there. And then I even said, I don't know what's next. I don't even know if I'm going to be what I've been. I don't know who I am. I don't know where I'm at. I'm trying to figure this out. And Pastor Greg Surratt looked at me and he says, Jason, I need to speak something over you. And he said this, Moses was perhaps the greatest leader that has ever been. But what he is known for was leading the people of Israel out of Egypt. That's what he's known for. I said, yes, sir. He said, but here is when that happened. It did not happen in the first part of his life. It didn't happen in the first part of his life, no matter how hard he tried to get it to happen. Remember the Egyptian he killed? What Moses is known for happened in the second half of his life. I want you to stand today. And when he said that, it all started to make sense. Now, again, I just prayed that prayer that day. God, I want to know your love personally, not academically, not proxy, not through another preacher, not through a friend, not through a spouse, not through my children, not through anyone else. God, I want to know your love personally. I just prayed that prayer. And he speaks this over my life about Moses. And then he says this, Jason, you have yet to do in your life what you'll be remembered for. And boy, I was like, yeah, but I didn't understand what that meant. Moses had passion. Again, he had charisma. He obviously was a strong leader. He obviously had all the attributes that people would normally look to follow someone like that. He was chosen for that purpose. God had given him all those ingredients. And then when he saw his opportunity, he struck. He ended up murdering a man. Moses tried to make that moment in God happen. And it set him back 40 years. He ends up in the backside of a desert. Why? Because Moses needed to know about God more than through academic means. He needed to know God personally, because it was going to take a personal relationship to do what God was calling him ultimately to do. And my word for somebody here today is this: you feel unseen. You feel like you're in the fight of your life. You feel like you're just drowning in whatever situation it is. And you do your best to hold your head up and act like everything's okay. And you feel that you've been enmasked in total obscurity. And I'm here to tell you, yeah, you are in obscurity. God has hidden you. God has put you in a dark place. He has removed you from the eyes and maybe from even the hearts of people for a purpose. Because he wants you to know his love, not academically, not because Pastor Daryl or Pastor Christian tell you that it's in the book, but God wants you to know his love personally. And sometimes, in order for us to know God's love personally, he has to strip everything away that we set up as idols before him. Do y'all get that? I got stripped from me everything that I thought I needed to be accepted by him. And all I needed to be accepted by him was me, was to be in relationship with him. Anybody feel hidden here today? I feel it. And I feel like I've come up against spiritual warfare in here today. I feel like I'm tapping on the door of something that needs to be opened. I'm rapping on that door going, come on. You feel hidden. And so today, whoever this is for, you've struggled with purpose. You've struggled with questions of your worth and your significance and of your value. But I want to tell you something. I want you to get this in your heart today. You have yet to do what you'll be remembered for. You've been hidden for a purpose.